Welcome to the Built on Purpose podcast, where on each episode we interview exceptional leaders, entrepreneurs, authors, philosophers, and some straight up interesting people to explore their outlook on life, work, and leadership. And now, here's your host, CEO and co-founder of Y Scouts, Max Hansen.
Welcome back to the Built on Purpose podcast, brought to you by Y Scouts. I'm your host, Max Hansen, the CEO of Y Scouts, where we find purpose-aligned and performance-proven leaders. Speaking of, today our guest is Alistair Sanderson, the CEO of Aperio Group, which specializes in comprehensive solutions and equipment for the manufacturing of tablet presses, tablet fillers, and ingredient supplies. With expertise in supplements, manufacturing, and global markets like China and Taiwan, Alistair is known for driving growth, innovation, and purpose and values-driven leadership in business. Alistair, welcome to the Built on Purpose podcast.
Thank you, Max.
All right. Well, we're going to jump in. I want to give the listeners just a little snippet of, tell them about Aperio Group today, and then we'll jump into obviously a lot of like how you got there, but just give a little introduction to what your role is today and kind of what Aperio Group is comprised of today.
Yeah, so I'm the CEO of Aperio Group, and it was formed about 2 years ago with the combination of two companies. And really over the last 2 years, we've managed to scale to almost 300 headcount and over $100 million in revenue.
Awesome, I love it. And I have worked with Alistair. It's been so fun watching him on this journey. It's like a blind eye, and he's growing faster and faster and faster. So what an incredible story. But Alistair, take us back. This is going to be fun for me. Take us back to the beginning of your entrepreneurial journey. Like, how did you get started in the business? How did you decide to, you know, start LFA Machines back then? But tell us how that started.
Yeah. So LFA is actually a shortening of London Fashion Arts, right? And so my brother and I started our entrepreneurial kind of journey on the markets in London. If you've ever been to London before, we used to actually have a stand on a market called Camden. It's like one of the biggest tourist attractions in London. And for the Americans listening to the podcast, it's kind of like halfway between a like farmer's market and a swap meet, right? You have like all these guys selling their wares. And we were selling like Banksy knockoffs. We would recreate Banksy's artwork because none of it was copyrighted. We'd just remake the stencils and we'd just like spray paint them out ourselves. So we would do this kind of graffiti work in this stencil artwork. And then we would also sell like Indian knitted jumpers, like hooded jumpers and kind of like bags and stuff like that. And so when we formed our company, you know, we started making a little bit of money. And when we formed our company, it was called London Fashion Arts because we were selling fashion and art in London. And then we went through like the pivot of all pivots and ended up in industrial machinery. You know, sounds like the natural progression, right? And so at that point, we started selling this industrial machinery. And we can get into that pivot if you want. But we were selling this stuff and all the invoices had London Fashion Arts on. And everyone was like, hey, why am I getting machinery from London Fashion Arts? Like, what's that about? And so we shortened it to LFA Machines. And that's kind of what became LFA Machines. And ultimately, that kind of morphed into Aperio after we did our first acquisition of Vivion.
Man, I didn't see that. I'm already learning stuff I didn't know. And for the listeners out there, Richard is business partner and brother. I didn't meet him for about, you know, first couple of years. I knew him when I met him. He's 6'8", or I think 6'8". Is that right?
Yeah. He's definitely a big guy. He was a force to be reckoned with on the market stands.
Exactly. And I'm 5'7". So when I met him, I'm like, holy crap, one tall dude. And Richard's your younger brother, correct?
Yeah. So when my brother and I started London Fashion Arts, I was 21 and he was 18. I'd kind of done the dropout of college thing and he had decided he didn't want to go to college. And so, you know, it was just after the 2008 recession and I was effectively unemployable. And we decided we were going to create our own job. You know, at that point, we really didn't have a lot to lose. You know, I think people can think that entrepreneurialness is like inherently risky. I don't actually think it is. I think entrepreneurs like often edge away from risk. But certainly at that time, the risk of us going into business was very, very minimal, you know?
Oh, yeah. Now, and I love where this is headed a bit because I've thought of this a lot and I hear people talk about this all the time. And I actually kind of laugh a little bit because I think everybody has to have, most people have this like dramatic story of like rags to riches, like type of like entrepreneurship. Unfortunately, I don't have that. I, you know, came from a very middle class family and nobody in my family owned a business. I just wanted to run a business. Like I don't, you know, and my family did help me. They paid for some of my college. So, but I think nobody wants that story. But what's your story? So what inspired you the most in order to like just make the leap? I mean, you got into it a little bit.
Yeah. But for me, it was really my brother. Like I was at an inflection point in my life where, you know, I'd gone through different kind of life informing, you know, things. I'd fallen out of college and I was quite undirectional, actually. I wasn't kind of very directional about what I wanted to achieve. And I think my brother saw in me a potential that maybe even I didn't see in myself. And so he said, hey, you know, I don't fancy going to college. You're not going back to college, right? Like that's a given at this point. Why don't we go and do something together? Like I've got the faith in you. And mine and my brother's relationship is really interesting, actually. We're very much a yin and a yang. Like I'm all go gas. I'm like the guy that like has 100 ideas a day and like just, and people often think that I'm the only person in the business because I'm the talker. Like I'll get out and talk. And he'll be the guy there that's actually sitting in the room, like really paying attention, listening to the details. And then afterwards, he'll go, hey, man, you missed this, 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 and this. And I'll go back into the room and be like, yeah, we missed this, 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 and this, you know? So it's like, we got this really kind of great, great dynamic in that sense. So I don't think there was I was always entrepreneurial kind of growing up, but I don't think there was ever kind of like a great plan around entrepreneurialism. Like my brother just saw something in me and said, hey, let's go give it a go. And off we went.
Yeah, awesome, awesome. And off you did go. What has it meant? You know, I know, like, what has it meant to have family involved in this business journey with you?
Yeah, I think I've seen a lot of different businesses, right? So I'm involved in a bunch of different business networking groups, and I really like to involve myself with other business owners. And I think for a lot of people, it doesn't always go right. But for myself and my brother, there's just so much respect and really respect for each other's craft. So I'm much more operational, much more tactical, I'm kind of much more hands-on. I'm that kind of auditor. I'm the speaker. I can communicate ideas. He's very, very thoughtful. He's very, very insightful. He's very, very kind of tactical and strategic. And then he also has just a really great understanding of the tech stack, the IT, the web, the SEO. He has a real eye for kind of perfection. And so it kind of got to the point where we just trusted each other and respected each other so much with our different skill sets that there's never been a moment of questioning whose decision it was when we came to a kind of decision, right? I would never question what our website would look like. He just does it really intuitively and does it so well. I just kind of back off and don't really do that. And I feel he does the same for me in kind of some of the deal stacks that we've done recently. You know, we've been very lucky to do three transactions and a sale lease back in the last couple of years. And he really has given me the space to get out and do that and kind of structure it how I want to. And I'll always bring it back around to him and be like, hey, are you okay with this? Are we going in the right direction? But he's given me that kind of space and that latitude to just be able to get on with my work. And I think that that's why it works so well for us, just that kind of really high level respect for each other's craft.
Yeah, and I've seen it firsthand. It does. Is there any, what I also see, Alistair, I don't know why, I always joke around when I do run into this, but somehow family business problems always find me. And usually it's because they're hiring an outside person for the first time. And
yeah, right.
And remember, like, report to them. And so sometimes I'm like, you know, I it's not something that I proclaim to be good at, but somehow I get put in a situation often and I'm dealing with like a father and their kids and like having separate phone calls. And I enjoy it because I, you know, I've just seen a few things on the hiring side that like make them aware of. But is there any advice that you give about keeping it healthy? It sounds like you've got a really healthy kind of family situation in your business. And didn't, am I remembering this right? Was your mom involved in your business at one point?
Yeah, our mom is involved in the business. We joked that we're generation 1.5 because like we started it and then we kind of hired her. But not in a very detailed. She's just kind of part time. But yeah, advice for working family. Yeah, just like I said, build that level of respect. For me, it all has to be built around respect. So I think that that's kind of it. And otherwise, the advice would be don't get involved. Like, you know, my brother and I are so blessed. I think, like you, I've seen it go wrong more times than I've seen it go right.
Yeah, absolutely. As somebody who's navigated the ups and downs of entrepreneurship, what do you believe are the key qualities or mindsets that have contributed to your success?
Yeah, so for me, it's one of the biggest learnings I've had, especially in the last couple of years as we've scaled. Because really, if we take a look at the business kind of pre-2020, we were very much a mom and pop shop, right? Sub 30 headcount, sub 10 million revenue, right? We were just kind of doing our thing and enjoying it. But since we've gone through this kind of explosive growth and really the journey that we've been on with yourself and Y Scouts, sure, for me, it's understanding that actually it's a good thing not to be the expert in the room, right? And like, how do you get those people who are, right? You would never file your own taxes. You would never like represent yourself in court. So like, why do you think you're your best salesman? Or like, why do you think that you're your best CFO? Like, you're probably not. There's almost certainly someone who's better than that, than you out there at that. And so like, that was a bit of a like, not a bit of, that was a really heavy gear shift that I had to go through, that like mindset from like, okay, when it's a sub 10 million, 30 headcount business, I can touch everything. I can make every decision. I can be involved in everything. But to go 300 headcount or north of 100 million, it just becomes impossible, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, speaking of that, like, I mean, obviously building any business requires taking risk. Is there any like pivotal moments or decision in your journey where taking risks paid off or taught you important lessons?
Yeah. Yeah. Although it might not seem like it on the initial surface. So I will never forget the day. I think it was like the 17th. I say I'll never forget the day. And then I say, I think it was the 17th of December, but I'm pretty sure it was the 17th of December. I wake up at like 7:30 in the morning to just like a bunch of text messages from my team in Taiwan, right? And our factory has burnt to the ground out there. And I mean to the ground. Like, they sent me photos and like the roof of the factory floor was like on the ground. And like, I can't explain it any other way, right? Everything was destroyed. All of our manufacturing capability, all of our inventory out there. Like, thankfully no one was hurt, but you know, couple of years of hard work into building that place up and obviously all the money in the building and stuff just completely taken out in one fell swoop. And I kind of looked at the situation, and the risk that I decided to take was I decided I was going to double my pricing. So I looked at the inventory that I had remaining, right? And I just figured, well, it's going to take me 6 to 12 months to be able to even start making new inventory again. So I have to sell it slower. And like, the best way I can think of selling it slower is to just like basically double my pricing on everything. And it seemed really risky, because like, if I stop making sales altogether, now I'm really screwed, right? Like, I'm not making sales and I've got all this expense of like trying to reset up the plant in Taiwan. But I was like, I need the cash. I need to be as profitable as I can be in this moment, right? I need to almost not let go of my inventory. I need to maximize every sale I can get. And so I'm just going to, the big risk I'm going to take in this moment, almost like the counterintuitive thing, right, is I'm going to just double my pricing. And we doubled our pricing and we lost sales. Like, make no mistake, we certainly did. But like, maybe 10% or 20%. And they're always the worst customers anyway, right? Like, those guys that like really bitch over the pricing, they're always, are we allowed to say words? Like,
you can say whatever you want. Yeah, this is a free zone.
Okay, cool. Yeah. But I sometimes get a little bit concerned about that. But I think that was like it felt like a massive risk in the moment. But what it taught me was actually people don't really buy your products and services based around pricing. A lot of the time they buy products and services around perceived value. And that's not necessarily intrinsically tied whatsoever to the cost of how much it costs you to make that product, right? Like, I'd always been pricing my products based on what it cost me to make them. Right. And I think a lot of people do that, right? It cost me X to make this, so it should be X plus whatever percentage. Right. And I think that risk in that moment kind of really taught me there's literally zero relationship between what it costs you to do something, make a product or a service, and what it should be sold for.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, hindsight 2020, it's like, oh yeah, of course you double your pricing, but like in the moment, that's a pretty ballsy, bad paid out. And by the way, pricing, you know, there's been a lot, since I went to college, I'm a lot older than Alistair. I graduated college in 98 and I went to the College of Business at a school in Flagstaff, which is like a tree hugger town. And bless the people at Flagstaff. It's probably a lot better now. But back then it was like, for the most part, I didn't figure this out till later. It was basically a bunch of old professors like smoking weed, telling me what business was like that they were involved in 30 years ago. But I remember thinking like nobody ever talked about pricing strategies. And then obviously since I graduated and kind of what's happened in the world, things have changed a lot. I mean, you think about pricing, to your point, is like, you know, the biggest company in the world, Amazon, they change their pricing millions of times all day long, to your point. Like nobody's like making their decision on pricing and holding off. They either need it and it's valuable or they don't. So it's so interesting to talk about pricing because I think everybody, not a lot of people would have the courage to make that decision. And I think a lot of people, in my opinion, including myself, sometimes catch themselves buying how they sell. Or selling how they buy, you know, like that type of mentality when it's really not, you know, that helpful. But tell me a little bit. I always was fascinated. I think this is how we kind of hit it off and, you know, still remain together today in some fashion. Talk about your approach and, you know, building a strong company culture and kind of the things that foster a sense of purpose and values amongst your team members. Because I think that was what, you know, when you're, you know, very few people, I always could see that was something that was important to you. And that's what, you know, kind of bonded us. But talk about how you've seen that and then talk about how it's, you know, kind of played itself out as you continue to acquire companies and scale your companies.
Yeah. So, you know, I've read all of the books and watched all of the podcasts, like, you know, Built to Sell or Start with Why, Simon Sinek. That's a really big cultural one, right? Yep. And sometimes you read these things and you think, I'm not saving the Amazon, right? Like, that's not my business. Like, you know, in fact, actually, you know, we're not quite as bad as tobacco and firearms, but we support the pharmaceutical industry, which is like just like somewhere like maybe above accountants, but below lawyers in the stack of like most hated industries, right? So like, it's sometimes I think when you take a look at your business and you listen to all this culture stuff, it says, hey, you should have a really strong culture and you should attract great people through culture. And I certainly went through a moment when I looked at my business and I was like, but we don't save the polar bears, right? Like, that's not a thing that we do here, right? So how do I build a culture that attracts and retains and holds on to good people? And for me, it was just kind of getting back to why we started the business, which kind of ties into the beginning, right? Like, I was at that moment in my life, and our core values, by the way, are building a community through caring, being supportive, or having high integrity. Sorry, very much on the spot right here.
They're talking.
I know them better than this. Building a community through being supportive, having integrity, bettering ourselves and caring. There we go. Take a breath. Get them. And that actually kind of dials back into what happened in the moment that the business was born into creation, right? My brother was incredibly supportive of me in that moment, right? We both care deeply for each other. We care for the product that we put out into the world, right? We had to better ourselves. Neither of us have a college education, right? We didn't know the first thing about business. We had to go out and learn all of this stuff, right? We wanted to build a community around ourselves, around people around us. And so I think actually core values are often just what is important to your founder, right? And that's why having a really strong sense of what that is really important, because when you start to attract people with really similar value sets to you, right, that makes them more sticky. That makes them believe in what you're doing. That makes them aligned with you. And then that kind of allows everybody to head in the same direction on the same cadence. I think that that's why it's really, really important. I don't think if you're a founder, you have to go out of your way to make something up, right? I think it's there. I think it's inherently inside you. And I also don't think you have to make it about something greater than what it just is. Okay, we're a for-profit business, right? In an industry. But we care deeply about the people inside our community, whether or not they be our vendors, our customers, our teammates, right? We're constantly wanting to better ourselves. So we attract people who are constantly wanting to better and improve themselves, right? We have high integrity. We're prepared to have difficult conversations, whether or not that be with a customer, a vendor, or about our teammates, about performance, right? So we attract people who are comfortable having those high integrity conversations. So we just, I think values are really important. They should be aligned to the leadership. And I think they should just be natural. They shouldn't be kind of artificially created. And I think if you do all of those things, actually what it does is just get a team of people who are all very aligned around one set of things heading in the right direction.
Gosh, 100%. Very well articulated. You know, what I see, you know, because we get to walk into some companies and sometimes they oversell their purpose and values, you know, on the front end. And then we're going in and like, wait a minute. But a lot of times companies, they get into problems and the way we kind of figure their way out with them is to find out, like, go all the way back. If a lot of times the founder's not in the picture anymore when this is the case, and figure out, like, why were they originally started in the first place, which goes to this point of, like, it doesn't have to be like something crazy off the charts, but it just need to go find that center point of, like, how was all this stuff created, from what point? And that's, you know, typically where we go. And when people are lost, when clients, their cultures get lost, that's typically, you know, the question is, like, well, let's go all the way back to the founder and figure out, you know, why they started the company in the first place. So that's super interesting. And, you know, obviously we know you well, and doesn't surprise me. And thanks for the insights. So, you know, a couple other things, and, you know, scaling a business involves obviously adapting to changes and seizing new opportunities. And this has been an interesting road for you guys, and you've grown very, very fast. But can you talk about a significant milestone or turning point in your business's growth trajectory and how you navigated it?
Yeah, so the first real significant milestone in growth was our first acquisition. And actually, when I first approached an M&A broker, it wasn't to buy another business. It was actually to consider selling mine. And I'm sitting in this guy's office and he goes, no. What you really want to do is turn yourself into this funny little thing called a platform, right? And I'm going to help you do it. And we kind of built out that strategy. And getting to that first acquisition once I understood what he was kind of saying, and I saw the opportunity and the challenge, I was excited by that challenge, that opportunity to be able to better myself and build something. I was like, okay, yeah, great. Well, let's get it done. But from that moment to the time that we actually got the first acquisition done, it was probably 18 to 24 months. It was a long process. And the navigation of it for me was just really kind of digging in and getting right into the weeds. Like, I literally read every single due diligence documents. Like, I just really threw myself at it kind of full bore, read all the books that I could, spoke to advisors. I'm a really big fan of, like I said, joining business and networking groups or having coaches or consultants. Like, I feel like there are so many people that know so many more things than me. And it's good to go out and get that advice. So yeah, I just started trying to dig into the knowledge wherever I could find it, whether it be books, podcasts, consultants, business networks, or ultimately just like right into the documents that I was being presented in front of me.
Amazing. Amazing. Is there, looking back, is there anything you would do if you would do differently, or any advice you'd give to
I have the heaviest balance sheet ever, and networking capital is a real challenge for us, right? Like, it's just the industry we're in. We sell industrial machinery and ingredients, both of which are not exactly asset light. You know, I think actually that's the reason why I went to sell the business. I think when you take a look at your business, if you're a business owner and you take a look at your business internally, like, it's really easy to see all of the imperfections, right? And it's with that kind of grass is always greener on the other side. And so I joke, oh, I'd go into a really asset light business so that I could scale it super quickly without too much need for capital. that would be the answer. If hindsight was 2020, I would have started a SaaS business, but then I would be in SaaS and you would be asking me the same question. And I'd be like, I don't want to compete with these Californians anymore. I just want to be in a really asset heavy business that's got a nice big moat around it that nobody can come and invade, you know? So Yeah, there are things that I would do differently. There are different steps, but I'm really happy with where we are today. And I'm really proud of what my brother and I and our team, our greater team, have achieved. It's certainly not been without all the people inside our organization. So, yeah, I think there are things that I'd change. I think for every pro, there's a con, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's, I was going to bring this up earlier, but we kind of, I moved it on. I've been thinking about it after being an entrepreneur since I was 26. I'm almost 50. If people ask me, you know, I've heard this question, you know, it's an overplayed question, is it worth it? And I actually, sometimes I got to admit, I sometimes think like, sometimes it hasn't been worth it. And I don't, I, but I would never go back and change it. I'm unemployable as well. But when I think about, I've created so much chaos and like, you know, been missed so many things because I'm focused on business, and I don't necessarily regret it. I'm just saying, if you objectively said it, was it worth it? Yeah, barely. And I would never go back because I couldn't change myself. But like some of it's, you know, it's heavy lifting and you get kicked in the nuts a bunch of times and you pick yourself up and you keep going. I mean, that's just the way it is. So
absolutely, man. My saying is there are days when you could offer me a pack of smokes and a case of beer and you could just have the keys to the building, right? Like if you caught me in that moment with a short contract, right, I might just sign it on the spot. And I would say that those days, some months they happen every other day. You know, there was a couple of weeks ago where it was just a brutal week. It just seemed like everything was not going to go my way. But like, you know, probably, yeah, literally 2 weeks straight. And at the end of it, I was just physically exhausted. I was totally shattered. But I think ultimately, you know, I am very happy with, you know, what's transpired. And for me, it's that journey, isn't it? It's not necessarily about getting to a destination. What would I be doing otherwise? I'd be working in a consulting firm like McKinsey. No offense to the guys from McKinsey, but yeah, I'm having a lot of fun out here doing it for real.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that, you know, I loved touching base with you on recently in one of our phone calls was, you know, you've got two younger kids, you've got an amazing wife at home and super supportive, and, you know, not everybody has that. So, you know, talk a little about that. Let's give a little airtime to your wife. And you know, it sounds like it's just amazing combo, partner in crime. But talk about how important that's been in your journey.
Yeah, for me, the family element is really important. For anyone who hasn't read it, you should go and Google a blog article called The Tail End on a blog called Wait But Why. I think it's by a guy called Tim Irvin. Actually, that blog article pretty much defines my philosophy when it comes to family, you know? And I think I'm doing this so that I can not only provide for them, but ultimately get to a point where I can spend more time with them. And before I set off on this journey, actually make the real scaling building journey, right? Like not the kind of mum and pup shop journey before, like the, okay, are we going to go gangbusters and see if we can make the major leagues, right? Like I kind of spoke with my very newly married wife at that point. We were like married 6 months and pregnant, kind of new, right? And I was like, look, if we do this, like, it could be 3 to 7 years, like, just the most brutal kind of slog. Like, I will be away on the road a lot. And she understood that it was a real opportunity, like I said, for me to go for the major leagues, right? You know, and she's been so supportive of that journey, and supportive in more than just like, you know, making sure that I have a home to come home to. She's like, no, really, you know, she's been mentally supportive, emotionally supportive. She's been physically supportive of the children, right? She's just been such a fantastic partner in that journey. I do think that us having that conversation together before we got into it was an important part in that step. And then another thing that's kept me really honest as well is we both keep up a practice of counseling, like couples counseling, you know, just as like a preventative measure. Because relationships are like those weird things, right? Like, and if you don't invest in them, when you need them, they're not there. Right. Like I heard someone say that recently, like during the good times is when you should actually be like doubling down on the investment. And so, yeah, she's just been a great partner and we've worked really, really well together. And she's just been incredibly supportive of the journey.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. It kind of reminds me, I was listening to a podcast today and it was Peter Attia and what's the British guy's name? That Modern Wisdom, the guy that does Modern Wisdom. So he's talking to Peter Attia. Peter Attia's point was, he's like, let's imagine for a minute that you all of a sudden had like the amount of money, the walkaway amount of money, whatever that is, double that. So you've got that. And said, let's imagine for a minute you had, you know, the physical health, you had that plus 20%, but there was nobody on the earth, but there were drones to do everything that you needed done. So you wouldn't like sacrifice your way of life, but you couldn't interact with anybody. What would that be like? And I don't think anybody's ever put it in perspective like that, as like, the only thing left you have is like relationships, you know, on earth. Mm-hmm. And, but so anyway, it was just interesting. So that's an interesting way to, you know, kind of think about it.
Yeah, it'd be miserable, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be totally miserable. Like, I think, you know, it goes back to the, in my opinion, like one of the most interesting things for me that I've ever seen and continues to play out is that Robert Waldinger's, you know, longest, study on humans. It's like three generations now. And yeah, literally the net is, he has got a new book. He just published it maybe 6 months ago, but the net is that the people that end up being the happiest in life and live the longest are the people that have healthy relationships and interactions.
Uh-huh. I mean,
it's just like, that's it. And it was a sample size. It was like people that weren't educated, people that were Harvard grads and then non-Harvard mm-hmm. grads. But to me, I've always just thought that was, you know, super interesting. And it kind of ties back to, you know, hiring and figuring out like if somebody's a good leader and person. But I think that there's something around, and I want to get your thoughts on this too, something around like when people are like, oh, you got 20 minutes to interview this person for me and tell me if they're a good leader. And I start thinking about that 20 minutes, you know, can't do a lot. But what I would dig into, knowing what I know about relationships and interactions, is that I'd ask them who their strongest professional relationships are, name the three, tell me why you have strong relationships, and tell me what your interactions are with them. And then tell mm-hmm. me the same thing on the personal side. And I've done that mm-hmm. a few times, and it's pretty, you know, it's staggering what people, you know, say mm-hmm. and can tell a lot. But what do you think about?
I would stack onto that two things. On the professional side, they should mention at least one coach or mentor.
Yeah.
I love it when I'm talking to someone in an interview and they're like, oh yeah, I learned this from this coach or this mentor. Like, because that shows to me like they actively go out and seek people who are wiser than them and have walked the path from them, and they're probably getting good guidance from those people, right? Like, that's a big thing for me. And then on the personal side, I had one guy in an interview tell me that he doesn't speak to his family anymore. And I was like, okay, thanks for coming, man. You know, like, what do you even say to that, right? Like, it's like, okay, you know, sometimes I guess things can go wrong, but with all of them, like, you don't speak to any of them anymore, okay?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What do you like to do? Like, I always like to jump into this because I think most people are, you know, listening and they're set leaders. And what do you like to do to this point? And like, keeping your saw sharp or however you want to put it and continue to learn. Like, what are some things that you do both like professionally and then personally to, you know, kind of stay sharp and stay ahead? I mean, I know since I met you, there was a point where you lost a bunch of weight and, you know, have seemed to keep it off. And so is there any advice and stuff like that you could give personally on kind of how you go about your day to day?
Like a day-to-day routine or just what I do to keep myself
whatever you think would be more helpful. It's just to kind of help people, you know, kind of either confirm they're on the right path or confirm that maybe they should try something different. Because clearly it's been, you know, it's been working for you. You're successful. You've got a great family. Everything's going pretty good.
Yeah, thank you. So my belief set, and this actually falls into a belief set rather than like a known, like I can't call it a philosophy or a definite thing, but my belief set is that you have to work really hard to get lucky, right? I do not attribute all of my success, whether or not it be in my relationship or whether or not it be in my business or anything, just to like my personal greatness. Like, I don't know if it's like an English thing or something, it just doesn't sit right with me. I have seen loads of good men and women work their ass off on reasonably decent business ideas and just not connected, you know? And I'm sure you've seen it more than enough, right, over the space of your career. And I'm sure that that's not what people necessarily want to hear, but sometimes you just have to be out in the ocean working really hard to catch that wave. right? And like, yeah, that's my analogy. If you're not out there and if you're not paddling really hard, if you're sitting on the beach, you're never going to catch a wave, right? So you need to be out there, right? And you need to be trying things and you need to be giving it a go. And then if you do that enough, you will catch a wave. I just don't know if that wave will come after 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, right? And so I think that that's really it for me. Like, for instance, with the weight loss, I went through like 5 or 6 different things before I found something that really connected. With the leadership style, I read a bunch of books, tried a different few things, and then I connected. With business, I mean, we've just had some completely lucky breaks, but I've worked really, really freaking hard for some of those lucky breaks. You know, I've kissed a hell of a lot of frogs. I think when it came to financing the first transaction, I probably knocked on like 50 bank doors or something. Just a ridiculous number. Just had so many telephone calls, spoke to so many finance guys, right? So you work really, really hard and then you get lucky. And sometimes you'll work really, really hard and you won't get lucky. And you need to just keep working hard.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, there's a, I pulled it up. I was trying to find it because it's so perfect for this. But there's a, I don't know where I heard this, but it said, hard work finds talent when talent works hard.
Uh-huh.
Like, I mean, it's like kind of the same, you know, it's exactly what you're saying. It's like, and I believe, you know, there's another, I can't remember who said this, but there, you know, a lot of these people, a lot of folks in self-help and self-development, like they've got their philosophies, which work for some. But I think like there is one, I don't know who this is, but thank God I don't know, because I'm going to kind of shit on it a little bit, but it's like be, do, have. And like, I think that's kind of, you know, kind of BS. I think, I can't remember who talked about this, but I think you just got to start doing, you know what I mean? You're not going to get anywhere unless you start just making progress and you have to do volume to start out before you're going to figure anything out. I think there's so many, entrepreneurship is so glorified out there that there are so many, you know, kids, unfortunately, that they don't see that you have to work hard to, you know, to catch those breaks. And, you know, a lot of times it sucks because they're never going to get the opportunity because they're never going to work hard enough. So
I had so many things that were failure to launch as well. Like, we talk about London Fashion Arts and this pivot into machinery, but there was like a gap when I sold everything from like glow sticks to shot glasses to like, remember those wicker basket egg chairs that like would hang outside? Yeah, like I was selling those for a while. At one point, we were literally selling the kitchen sink. We were like selling faucets and stuff, right? Like, I used to joke, I'll sell everything, including the kitchen sink. But we were trying to like find a product that was like market product fit, right? And we weren't being tactical or strategic about it. We were just like throwing up a bunch of stuff against the wall and figuring out what eventually stuck. So we just worked really hard and then found a product, a niche, a market that kind of stuck, right? So yeah, I just think getting out there and doing it is definitely the most critical thing. I was reading a book recently, How Will You Measure Your Life? Or a book along that lines. Can't remember the exact title. It was a really good book. I think it's called How Will You Measure Your Life? And they were talking about this kind of idea that you can have a plan of where you want to take things, right? But if you're too rigidly stuck to that plan, you'll almost certainly fail, because at some point as you walk that journey, an opportunity will arise and you have to be ready to like diverge from the plan and then take the emergent opportunity and then try and take that to the next step. I think that also kind of like builds on that idea of just be out there, be on the playing field, work really, really hard. Don't get too fixated on any one goal, right? Know you're on a journey. And then when that moment of opportunity comes, when that wave is there and it's ready to go, notice it's a wave and get on it and keep working really, really hard. And that'll ultimately get whatever it is that you're trying to do off the ground, whether it be work on your personal relationships or your body or your business. I really do believe that.
Yeah. Do you, can you share growing up, in England, like what, and now that you've traveled the world culturally, like how did that shape you differently? Whether that be good, bad, or indifferent, but talk about, you know, being raised, from Britain, like to be British, like, does it help for you? Like, you know, So I love the accent. Sometimes I'm like, I'm gonna have Alistair make my my voice
voiceover.
Do my voiceover. Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah.
Talk about, like, you know, back being raised. I mean, where you're raised and how you're raised, like, does British culture help you be a better entrepreneur? Like, talk a little bit about that now that you've been able to travel the world and see it from a different lens.
So I know, I think the British old entrepreneurialism is very stifled, very stifled. The market over there is very stifled. We only have 7 banks or something ridiculous like that. I think there are like 700 in the state of Omaha or like Oklahoma, right? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just ridiculous. Like, we don't have anything like the SBA in the UK. We don't have anything that's akin to a 7A loan. So for those of you inside and outside of America, a 7A loan is just this fantastic opportunity for a young entrepreneur to be able to go out and buy a business with government funding in the United States. And it's really cleverly structured. The way that it works is just fantastic. It gives everybody that real American opportunity to like build something of themselves. If you don't know what it is, go Google it. It's fantastic. And honestly, I think that Europe should implement something like the SBA. They should have 7A loans. They should have SBIC funds. This is how you develop entrepreneurs. You give them access to capital in a very kind of structured and thought through manner. And Europe kind of holistically, but Britain in particular, just doesn't have that. We only have like 3 supermarkets. I mean, it's just not a competitive society at all, especially considering the fact that there are like 65 million people there. I think what gave me my competitive edge, without getting too personal, is I grew up in a very middle class family. It wasn't that there was never food on the table, but like I understood what the concept of a mortgage was and how important it was to get it paid monthly, right, by about the age of 10, right? But I was lucky in the fact that I got a scholarship to go to a private school. I actually got a scholarship to go to a boarding school. And so very early on, I was exposed to the very, very other end of the spectrum, like kids being dropped off at school in Ferraris. And I think that that kind of fostered this hunger for wanting to go out and kind of make something or hustle. And like my earliest businesses were at boarding school, just selling products to the other kids at boarding school, right? And so that kind of early hustle was installed in me there. And then actually it was only when LFA made it to America that I really got to start to stretch my legs as an entrepreneur once I got access to the capital and the markets and people wanted to go out and invest. I don't think that what we've done with Aperio would have ever been even close to achievable in the United Kingdom, sadly.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. Super interesting. I was the podcast I was listening to earlier today. He's British, the guy from Modern Wisdom. He joked around and he said that he went to Ibiza, and going to Ibiza from, you know, from there is like going to Cancun from us, you know, Texas.
Yeah.
And he's like, you want to ruin a vacation city? Get a direct flight from London to whatever city that is. And he was kind of giggling, just because, you know, the other thing, and this is kind of in form of a question to you, but kind of poking fun too. But I mean, he made it seem like, and this is confirmed, that, you know, when the English go on vacation, like even the adults, they're drinking in the morning. That's just really, you know, more accepted, I think, than probably a little bit more in the U.S. So what is your take on that? Like, what did you grow up that way and viewing it that way, or is it now?
Yeah. So, I mean, England has a heavy drinking culture, right? And there were certainly times in my life when I partook in that heavy drinking culture. This has not been my only business. I've been involved in a number of other businesses. Like I said, I think like natural entrepreneurialism, I like kind of lean that way. I started a company with a couple of friends, and from our office to the flat where we lived, we had to walk past a number of different pubs. But one of these pubs in particular was a certain chain in England called a Wetherspoons. And it's like halfway between an English pub and a Cracker Barrel. Like, I can't describe it any other way. You can get a meal for like $7.99, but it comes with a pint, right? And so 3 young guys running this business, walking home at like 6 p.m. after a hard day's work, right? We can get a meal for $7.99 with a pint. Like, of course we're stopping, right? And the breaking point was always the third pint. Like, if the third pint happened, all bets were off. Like, we were definitely going to work very hungover the next day. So there is a strong English drinking culture. I don't actually drink anymore. I find it gets in the way. I stopped drinking, I want to say 2018. So what are we now? 2024, like over 6 years ago. Haven't drunk for 6 years. I just feel like it took the edge off. Like, I wasn't as sharp. I was, you know, I had a lot to do. I wanted to grow this business. I really wanted to make something of it. And so I kind of nixed it. I met my wife, well, sober. She was sober. It wasn't that I ever had like an alcohol problem per se. It wasn't an alcohol benefit, right? And yeah, she wasn't drinking. So now neither of us drink. I don't think I'll never drink again. I might drink again. I just don't kind of really feel the longing for it.
Yeah, so, no, yeah. I appreciate you sharing that. I still drink, but it is more rare. And when I do drink, I like take like medicine that will help me like metabolize the alcohol faster. And like, I'm, you know, thinking through like the next day. Not when I was younger,
Right.
I mean, I think it's like we think about just alcohol in general, the ROI of it's just not, you know, where it used to be. And I also like, I don't know why all this is coming to me at once. I also heard, and it was like a post, that the number of clubs in the UK is down to 50% of what it used to be 10 years ago, which, like, you know, they're saying a lot of things. I think part of that's less consumption of alcohol. And I think, you know, more of it's maybe people that like hanging out in nightclubs anymore. They'd rather go to music festivals or whatever that might be. But I think a part of it definitely has to be with the, you know, smart people are starting to figure out, like, maybe alcohol, the ROI, it's not worth it. I know I've figured that out. I just still drink a little
bit. Yeah. If alcohol was invented today for the first time, right? Imagine it never existed in history before, and it was invented in this moment in time, right here today. It would instantly be a Schedule One drug. Like, there would be no doubt whatsoever, right? It would go join the ranks of all of the other really dangerous shit, right? It gets you really, really wasted really, really quickly, and you make terrible decisions when you're on it. Like, there's no way that we as society discovering alcohol today would be like, yeah, that's a totally okay thing. You know, I think that it is important for people to be able to unwind, express themselves how they want, and ultimately do with their bodies as they see whatever's fit, right? And so I understand the pleasure that people get from, you know, drinking or, you know, smoking, whatever it is that they want to do. But for me personally, I've just got to that point in my life where the kind of reward isn't worth it. You know, it's just not worth the payoff. I think it was Richard Branson. I heard Richard Branson saying, drinking alcohol is stealing a little bit of happiness from tomorrow.
Oh, shit.
Especially
if you have kids.
Especially,
I always feel
right?
happiness is bringing misery.
Right? Can you imagine watching puppy paws while hungover? I can't think of anything worse, you know?
Man. Well, if you haven't been, this is actually a formal invite and it's recorded too. But if you ever want to go check out a bunch of drunk people where it's super entertaining, I shouldn't say drunk, but people that are, you know, drinking and partying, the Phoenix Open is probably the best scene you've ever seen in your life.
Oh, the waste management, huh?
Yeah, there's hundreds.
Oh, dude, I'm in.
Okay. So we can, you know, you might have to have a pint when you sit there, you know, not too much, enough to like watch folks. But man, I've never seen an environment that feels so fun. The weather is so perfect that everybody just feels like they, you know, they just need to drink, and you just see people falling over left and right. But let's do it in Arizona, you know, next year if you're around. It's Super
Bowl. February time, isn't it?
Super Bowl weekend. It's that week. It's the week before Super Bowl. So
that's another one on my bucket list. Damn, I want to go to the Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah. I have been to the Super Bowl. It is something I want to go again for sure. Is there anything else, like anything else that I didn't ask? Because I didn't even get in. I knew this was going to flow this way. By the way, this has been amazing, and I don't say that every time. It's been amazing because we did touch a lot on business, but I think when people listen to podcasts, they also kind of want to hear, like, all right, that's cool, he's crushing his business, but like some of this other stuff you know touched on, and I've got so many other questions, but I want to be thoughtful of your time and respectful of your time. But there was like questions around, you know, the supplement industry and manufacturing and, you know, international stuff. But is there anything, like, after doing all the shit that you've done professionally, and I mean that in a respectful way, like anything that comes to mind, like, yeah, this is like something that I would, you know, that this is on my mind now, or something that is something that I think about a lot that we haven't already talked about?
No, I don't think there is. I mean, because we touched on the personal, and I think for me at the stage that I'm at, and I think you go through arcs, right? Like moments in life, and I think there are phases in life, and I think the phase that I'm in at the moment is very much like figuring out, okay, in the next phase, how do I balance my business a little bit more with the family? Because like you said, I have two young kids. So like I'm going through a kind of like gear shift change. And I think that's really it for me. I feel like a business should really serve its owner, not the other way around. I think a lot of times it ends up being the other way around. Like business owners just end up shackled to their businesses, right? And they just really have to serve them every moment of every day, right? Out of this fear of it just like falling apart in their absence or just turning to smoke or whatever. And I think the next phase for me is really about, okay, how do I get my business to do what it should as a business owner, you know, and actually drive value for me as a business owner. So I think, you know, that's what I'm looking forward to over the next few awesome. Years.
Well, thank you for your time today. Like, again, I don't not on every episode, I swear I don't say this, but this was absolutely amazing. I can't wait for, you know, folks to hear this. It's been amazing working with you and
it's been great working with your team too, man. It really is about the people, right? Everybody says that. It's not what you do, it's the people you work with. And I feel like Y Scouts is exonerated, like really personified that for me in so much as finding those really good people. Because as an executive leader, building out a really solid C-suite around you, it's really important thing to do. And you guys have been really instrumental. So thank you very much, man.
And I'm not paying him to say this. This is this.
Yeah, you can mail me the 20 later, right?
All right.
Well, those waste management tickets you promised, right?
No, that's it. Yeah, exactly. That greased him up a little bit. Well, listen to the Built on Purpose podcast with Max Hansen, brought to you by Y-Scouts. You can listen to all of our future and past episodes at yscouts.com. Thanks again, Alistair. You're absolutely amazing.
Thanks for listening to the Built on Purpose podcast, where on each episode, we interview exceptional leaders, entrepreneurs, authors, philosophers, and some straight up interesting people to explore their outlook on life, work, and leadership. You can hear any of our previous shows 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts.